farmers dragging out their folding tables and canopies in the pre-dawn dark. He also saw one of his supplementals, Milton Ramos, from Dennis Doyle's squad in the 4-6, standing on the edge of the scene watching the techs stow their gear. Billy had been trying to keep his distance from the guy all tour. Like a number of one-offs, there was something not quite right about him. He seemed to be both on edge and spacey. Plus, Billy was pretty sure that he'd been slipping off fairly steadily to drink. Not that Ramos would have been the first detective on night watch to sweeten the long hours and boredom that way. Feely's eyes often looked like two cherries floating in buttermilk. But that was Feely. The CSUs, both female, were hunched over the hood of their van now, sorting through their report forms. "So how is the Great Tuna robbery?" Billy asked Ramos. "Anything fishy about it?"
"I think it was an inside job," Ramos said flatly.
He was short and thick, but too powerfully built to be called fat, his slitted features hidden beneath thick brows and a permanently impassive expression. Billy had him pegged as a complete loner, on the job and off, the type of uncommunicative, humorless near-blank that made everyone in his home squad uncomfortable.
"You know," Ramos said, looking around the park, "I used to work midnights my first 2 years, but now, I don't know if I could handle it anymore. How does your wife put up with it?"
"She's a nurse," Billy said. "She can put up with anything short of me having a second family."
"Oh, yeah? What kind of nurse?"
ER, but over the years she's done it all.
"Done it all, seen it all. Easy going?"
Billy gave him a look.
"Philosophical about things," he lied. "Philosophical," Ramos nodded, still looking away. "Shit happens."
"Something like that." Billy saw Stupak coming from the Irving Place homicide, enter the park and head toward the tents and tables, waiting for someone to open up. He raised his cell to call her.
"She always want to be a nurse?" Ramos asked.
"What?"
"Your wife."
"What is this, an interview?"
"No, I'm sorry, I just... My wife, she passed 7 years ago."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Billy said, killing the call.
"Yeah, hit and run."
"I'm sorry."
"We have a daughter, she's 8,
he said. Then,
"If the mother's dead and you say we, is it we have a daughter or we had a daughter?"
The guy was definitely sauced, but he was talking about losing his wife.
"Grammar wasn't my strong suit," Billy said. "You have kids?"
"Two boys."
"Two boys, double the trouble."
Billy impatiently checked the time, 6:15 in the a.m., the crime scene tech still hunched over the hood working up their reports.
"Back when we were kids," Ramos moved closer to him, "me and my brother, we were the terror of the neighborhood."
"Oh, yeah?" Billy tried to call Stupak again. "What neighborhood was that?" Ramos either didn't hear him or didn't want to answer.
"What are you doing?"
Billy asked Stupak. "Where are you?" "By the Gandhi statue waiting on CSU. Bring me a coffee, cream and sugar, and a buttered roll."
"You know," Ramos plowed on, "before she died, my wife was an X-ray technician at Beth Abraham for 5 years. So I know a little about nurses. And the little I know is they're not like cops, you know what I'm saying? You don't become a nurse because your mother and grandmother were nurses. So forgive me for getting personal, and you can tell me to mind my own business, but I'm curious. Why do you think your wife became a nurse?"
"Now I'm supposed to say, because she likes to help people?"
"Not at all. I was just wondering if there was any one moment where she, you know, like an event or something."
Billy gave him another long look.
"Like with me," Ramos said quickly. "I never thought I was going to be a cop. I was a troubled kid, a fighter. But when I was 17, I lost my mother and 2 brothers all like within a month's time. And I needed a place to hide."
"What do you mean, hide?"
"Not hide, more like I needed a structure, you know. Be part of something that would give me all the do's and don'ts. keep me from going over to the dark side. It took a few years, but here I am. Here you are, Billy said, not liking this guy at all, him and his copious tragedies. One of the techs finally came over, peeled off a copy of the report for Billy, then headed off to the green market with her partner. Beautiful, right? Ramos said, as the sun began to paint the tops of the ancient office buildings at the western edge of the square. Billy loathed sunrises. He knew them as cruel mirages, each one a false promise that a tour had come to its end, when in fact, depending on the time of year, there were anywhere from 1 to 3 hours left for that phone to ring with a fresh disaster. Sunrises, like Ramos here, made him tense. They made him feel fucked with. Listen to me, Billy said abruptly. You've had liquor on your breath all night. Frowning, Ramos looked away. I'm not going to write you up, but I don't ever want to see you on my tour again. In fact, you can take off right now. I'll sign you out when I get back to the office. At first, Ramos didn't respond, his frown deepening into a scowl. But then he began nodding his head as if having come to some kind of decision. I apologize, he said quietly, turning back to Billy and handing over the keys to the squad sedan. And I appreciate the courtesy. Ramos walked off toward the 14th Street subway entrance without another word, Billy watching him all the way, wondering if he had been too hard on the guy. Then, tired of waiting for Stupak to deliver his breakfast, he wandered over to the market himself, where he discovered that almost all the cops involved in the 3 wee-hour local felonies were now cruising the food stalls as intensely as if they were at a gun show. Walking into the house with 2 biodegradable bags filled with agave-sweetened muffins, crullers, and donut holes, it seemed to Billy that the only one up and about was the 6-year-old. Carlos sitting in the dining room and eating the breakfast he had made for himself, a teacup of orange juice and an unthawed Eggo. Where's your mother? Billy asked, dropping the waffle into the toaster. Is she still sleeping?
I don't know.
Where's your brother?
At Theo's house. He slept there on a sleepover.
Through the kitchen window, Billy saw his father sitting on a lawn chair beneath one of the Taru cameras in the backyard, the old guy, as usual, reading the New York Times. How's Grandpa today?
I don't know, Carlos said. Then, a teacher in my school got quit.
What do you mean, got quit?
He's not a teacher anymore.
Oh, yeah? What teacher?
Mr. Lazar.
Mr. Lazar quit? Or got fired?
I don't know.
Why? He couldn't imagine that the school would can him for being gay.
He hurt some guy, Carlos said.
What do you mean, hurt? Hurt what guy? Billy trying to remember the name of Lazar's potential blackmailer.
He got took away,
Carlos said.
Lazar?
Mr. Lazar. Who took him away?
The police guys at release time. I'm going to the basement. Dex said there's a mouse.
Billy went up to his bedroom, quietly crept past his wife, her flank beneath the sheets swelling and dipping like a chain of dunes, and stowed his weapon and handcuffs in the closet. Then, intending to call the Yonkers PD to find out about Lazar, he went back down to the kitchen. A few minutes later, while he was still on hold with the 2nd Precinct Detective Squad, the doorbell began to chime. Assuming the callers were either evangelists or Con Ed and worried that a second round of chimes would wake Carmen, he stepped briskly into the hallway and swung the door wide to see Milton Ramos standing on his doorstep. Stone-faced and thick as a stump, his razored eyes staring past Billy and into the house, as if he weren't even there. Thinking that he was probably stuporously drunk by now, and angry about having been booted from night watch 3 hours earlier, Billy was about to try to talk him down when Ramos reached behind his back, Billy vaguely thinking for some kind of letter of complaint, and came out with a Glock. "Where is she?" Ramos said. Billy took a step outside the house, then made a big show of holding up his hands for the Taru cameras, though he had no idea whether anyone was even monitoring them. "Where is she?" Ramos repeated, muzzle shoving Billy back inside as far as the living room while efficiently patting him down with his free hand even though they were both still in motion. So,
not stuporously drunk. Ramos, he couldn't remember his first name. What are you doing?
Where is she?
This time Billy heard the question.
Where's who?
Your wife.
My wife?
Your wife, your wife, your wife, he said, as if fed up with a blockhead.
Hang on, hang on, I'm the one who gave you grief.
Done with the basement, Carlos wandered into the room, and without looking at either Ramos or his father, took a seat on the couch and picked up the remote.
Hey, buddy, not now,
Billy said, his voice starting to float.
Go outside.
He stays, Ramos said, letting the kid settle in and find his show.
Look, just say, Billy struggling not to plead.
What do you want?
I told you already, Ramos said, then tilting his chin to the sound of footsteps coming from above.
She's up there? Call her down. She still doesn't recognize me.
Ramos was addressing Billy, but his eyes were on Carmen, sitting across the room from him as stiff as a pharaoh, her own gaze fixed on the floor.
How can that be?
Carlos, absorbed in his cartoons, was sitting alongside Ramos on the couch now, the automatic hidden beneath a throw pillow between them.
What do you need the kid for? Billy said, striving for an offhand tone. Just let him come to me.
Ignoring Billy, Ramos leaned forward to get Carmen to look at him. She wouldn't.
But you remember Little Man, right?
He said.
You're Milton,
Carmen whispered dully.
Maybe I'm Edgar. Edgar's dead,
she said in that same downcast hush.
So you know, he said.
Billy, barely listening, finally became aware that there was a real conversation going on, neither Ramos nor his wife raising their voices.
My whole family in the ground where you put them, Ramos said to her. And all these years, I never knew why.
Carlos half stood to reach for the remote again, Ramos slowly raising a hand to grab him in case he decided to bolt, but the kid fell back into the cushions on his own.
Milton, I'm right in front of you. I'm right here,
Carmen's voice, despite the danger, still jarringly flat.
Please don't hurt my son.
He's not going to hurt him, Billy said lightly, his heart blowing like a bellows. He's got a daughter of his own, right? The sound of the back door opening had Ramos half rising, the automatic now down at his side. But at the sight of Billy Sr. standing in the doorway, ruffled sections of the weekend paper tucked under his arm, he eased himself back down, slipping the gun once again beneath the pillow.
What are you coming so early for? Billy Sr. said, stepping into the den. I'm on nights this week, didn't they tell you?
I just came by to visit your son, Ramos said easily. I'll be back for you later.
Well, see you then, my friend.
Billy's father gave a short wave and left the room the same way he came in. At first, Billy was baffled. But then he realized that his father had been talking to his replacement driver, and that Ramos was the one who had been torturing them for weeks.
Milton, she had called him.
There was a glass snow globe from Jiminy Peak on the windowsill, a brass candlestick on a side table, the snow globe closer but still too far away.
Tell me why you did it, Ramos said.
Carmen tried to raise her eyes to Carlos, couldn't.
Milton, I'm scared to look at him. Please.
Carlos, buddy, come on over to me, Billy said. Ramos, be a good guy. Just let him come.
Tell me why you did it.
I never meant to, she said. You have to believe that.
Ramos, be a good guy. Why?
Ramos, you do something here. How much time do you think you'll ever have to be with your daughter? She's already lost her mother. You told me yourself.
Why? Because he broke my heart,
Carmen said, her voice barely carrying across the room.
He what?
Ramos cocked his head, draped an arm atop Carlos's shoulders.
think it through, Billy said, eyes back to roaming for weapons. Broke my heart.
Broke your heart? Ramos said. He got you pregnant?
No, but he was fucking you. More a question than a statement. Carlos started to fidget under the weight of his arm, but Ramos was too absorbed to even notice.
Be cool, buddy, Billy said to his son.
He never even looked at me but once, Carmen said.
Out the window, Billy saw a fleet of patrol cars and a Yonkers ESU van rolling up to the house. Their presence, prayed for earlier, now heightening his sense of danger.
I was 15 years old, Carmen said heavily. They came up to me on the stoop. He had just hurt my feelings. I was mad, and I said what I said.
Astonishingly, understandably, Carlos fell asleep against Ramos's shoulder.
You were 15. He had just hurt your feelings. And you just said what you said,
Ramos recited to himself.
Hurt your feelings? That's it?
You want a better story? Carmen softly crying now.
I don't have one.
The house phone rang. Hostage negotiators for sure, Billy knew, no one making a move to answer it.
You know something?
Ramos said to Carmen, his voice filled with wonder.
I believe you.
15 years old. I don't know what I was expecting to hear all these years.
The fax line began to ring in the den, followed by Carmen's cell phone in the hallway.
Would it be too little for me to say that I pray for him every day of my life? She asked listlessly.
Yeah.
Ramos getting to his feet, the Glock rising in his fist.
It would.
Before Billy could launch himself, his father reappeared in the doorway, this time with his ancient .45 double-gripped and leveled at the back of Ramos's head. When Ramos wheeled to the threat, then kept coming, Billy Sr. fired, although the fucking thing might as well have had a bang flag pop out. Billy lunged for the snow globe on the windowsill, then Giant stepped forward and cracked it against Ramos's near temple, sending him milk-eyed to the floor, the side of his face shining with viscous liquid and glitter. For a moment, Carmen just stood there, as if lost in whatever they had been talking about. Then, snapping out of it, she scooped Carlos from the couch, screamed, "Billy, come!" And when he wouldn't, his father was in the house too, remained in the doorway, her legs trembling like jackhammers, until he shoved her out of the house, toward the cops. Having no idea where the Glock had gone, Billy snatched his father's .45 out of his hands, then dropped down to straddle Ramos's broad back, the sheer breadth of it stretching the tendons in his groin. Billy Sr. headed up the stairs.
Dad!
Billy yelled, but the old man kept climbing. With all the phones in the house continuously ringing as if to announce a royal wedding, all the phones except, strangely, Billy's own, Ramos began to come around, his eyes slowly opening and closing like something in a terrarium. Billy pressed the .45 hard into the nape of his neck, then searched him for cuffs. Nothing. He had to get to a phone and give Yonkers the green light to come on in before he lost control of the situation, but he couldn't risk rising up with Ramos unsecured, couldn't risk him seeing the barrel-plugged gun full on and recognizing it for what it was, couldn't risk him finding his own live piece somewhere in the room.
There's like a fucking army out there, okay? Billy said, trying to keep the tremble out of his voice. So just take it easy, okay?
Ramos winced, then slightly, effortlessly, shifted beneath Billy's weight, Billy knowing right then that he wasn't physically strong enough to keep him down if it came to that.
Milton, right? Milton, think of your daughter, okay? Just think of your daughter and everything is gonna be okay, okay?
Ramos was fully alert now, but he made no further effort to move. Just lay there with the side of his face half buried in the high nap of the carpet, staring off as if thinking about something unrelated.
Your daughter, what's her name? Billy chattered. Tell me your name.
Clearly the calmer of the two, Ramos continued to stare off, Billy's bulk and the pressure of the muzzle no more distracting than pecking birds on the back of a rhino.
Come on, Milton, tell me her name.
Ramos cleared his throat.
If somebody in your will is down as your kid's guardian, he said, his voice half muffled by the pile, and you go to jail instead of dying, do they still get the kid?
Yeah, sure, Billy said automatically, ducking then swiveling his head in a low search for the cast-off automatic. Or does jail throw the whole guardian arrangement out the window? Billy thought he saw what might be the gun lying deep under the couch, but it could just as easily have been one of the kid's toys.
She likes it out there with her aunt, Ramos continued. I don't want her going to foster care.
Sure, Billy babbled. She stays wherever you decide.
What do you know?
Ramos said calmly, then threw Billy off his back as easily as doing a push-up. The Glock, now pointed at Billy, had been under Ramos the whole time Billy had been riding him.
Over there, Ramos said, on the table.
Billy did as he was told, putting his father's gun on the low coffee table.
The fucking thing's plugged anyhow, Ramos added.
If he knew that all along, Billy thought dreamily, and his own live piece was right under his gut.
We can get out of this, no problem, Billy said. Just let me pick up the phone, or pick it up yourself.
Turn to the wall, please.
Billy did as he was told, so stupid with fear he felt high.
Did you know?
Ramos asked him from behind.
Did I know what? She never told you.
Ramos marveled.
Tell me what? Billy said.
Then, so tell me now. I want to know.
Never said a word.
As fine cracks in the wall paint, inches from his face, imprinted themselves on his brain, as the hell choir of endlessly ringing phones faded to a weak, sickly carousel tune in Billy's ears, Ramos took two steps back.
You see?
His voice tearing up blackly.
All these years, and you fucking people, you just sail on, sail on.
Billy tried to shut himself down and just let it happen, but then he heard Ramos stepping back farther, then heard the front door swing open, the murderously pregnant silence out there rushing into the house like a tornado. He wasn't sure what he experienced first, the staggered report of the volley or the sight of Ramos charging the ESU cops with Billy Sr.'s dummy gun. Either way, the outcome was the same. Either way, the phones finally stopped ringing. As the house filled with footsteps and radio squawk, Billy, intent on finding his cell phone, tuned out the calming voices, shrugged off the reaching hands that were screwing with his concentration.
Where did it go?
Where'd what go, Billy? Someone said. My goddamn phone, I just had it this morning. It's in your front pocket, the voice said. Why don't you come sit down? Pulling out his cell, Billy saw that there was someone on the line. Who's this?
Graves, is that you?
A familiar voice said.
I asked who this is,
Billy said, finally allowing someone to guide him to a chair.
Evan Lefkowitz, second squad.
You're calling me?
Actually, you called me, us, about an hour ago, then left the line open, Lefkowitz said. We've been listening in ever since.
Hey, while I have you, Billy said brightly, waving off the hovering EMTs, I was talking to my son earlier. What's the deal with Albert Lazar? A new call came in while the medics were debating whether to shoot him up with 3 mics of sodium nitroprusside or let his blood pressure come down on its own.
Hey, Billy, Bobby Cardoza from the 80s squad. We finally got a match on the prints from the bat.
Good, Billy said, watching the needle go in.
Are you sitting down? Because you're not going to believe your ears.
By the time they finally laid eyes on each other in the trauma room of St. Joseph's, Billy was so dizzy from the nitro press, Carmen so bombed on Ativan, that for a while all they could do was stare.
Who's got the kids?
Millie, she said. Then,
Billy, I'm so sorry.
In the ensuing stoned silence, fragments of her conversation with Ramos began to revisit him.
You knew he'd be coming for you?
I knew something would be coming for me, she said. I just didn't know what.
Billy nodded, then nodded some more. So, clearing his throat, who's little man? It took 2 days of her pretty much sleeping around the clock before she was prepared to answer the question, Carmen announcing her readiness on the third afternoon by coming downstairs in a long plain white nightgown, silently drinking 2 cups of coffee, then inviting him back upstairs. Once they were inside the semi-darkened bedroom, Carmen immediately slipped back under the covers. But Billy, intuiting that she might need some breathing room for whatever was to come, opted for the lone chair, lugging it across the room from its spot beneath the far window to the side of the bed.
When I was 15, she began, I would have done anything, anything, to have Rudy Ramos like me, just like me. You have no idea what I thought of myself back then. My father was so rotten, such a lousy human being, and my mother was his dish rag. Then my father left it for another woman and moved to Atlanta, which was good, I thought, because now it would get better between us. But she just, overnight, turned into this sour old widow. I would be like, Mommy, be happy, you're free. But no, she just, who'd want me now? I mean, she was good-looking, 37 years old, but she just shut herself down, started yelling at me and Victor nonstop over nothing, anything, just never let up.
Despite the marathon hours she had spent recuperating in this room, Billy thought he had never seen her look so exhausted, her eyes like swollen almonds beneath half-masked lids.
And I knew Rudy, little man everybody called him, from the building and from school. Not knew him, he was a year ahead of me, but... And I didn't think about him all that much, then one day I just did. And I couldn't stop. It was like I had suffered a stroke, but I was nothing to him. Just some ghost of a girl who lived where he lived and went to Monroe. He was a big deal on the basketball team. In between games and practices, he'd hardly ever leave school before 5 o'clock. And a lot of those days I'd find things to do in the after-school program so I could go home when he did. I mean, I was so fucked up that I wouldn't even walk on the same side of the street as him. But I'd always manage to enter the building when he did, so we'd go up the stairs at the same time. And I hated that I lived one flight below him, because if I lived on his floor or the one higher, then that would be one more flight. I'd have to be near him, just day after day like that, agonizing over how maybe tomorrow I should walk in front of him instead of behind him instead of in front of him. And his bedroom was right above mine, 3F and 4F, and I'd hear him walking around above my head, and sometimes he'd be doing himself, and the bed springs would creak. And I'd lay down in my own bed, and...
Whoa, whoa.
Billy, please, let me tell you.
Carmen, I can't hear this.
Why? You're the man I love, the father of my children, and I'm telling you things about me that I never could before.
Okay, okay, Jesus.
What, are you jealous? He's been dead more than 20 years.
Don't be ridiculous. Billy scoffed, thinking, she's been cheating on me with this kid, walking around with him in her head since the day they met. Then, as quick as the feeling had come down on him, it lifted, Billy recognizing that what was really getting to him was not jealousy, but the realization that if he hung in for this right now, that baffling and invisible dragon he'd been protecting her from all these years might finally begin to take on form, and he might not be able to handle its appearance.
Are you angry at me? She said. Do you want me to stop? I'll stop, I will, just tell me to.
Don't be ridiculous, he repeated.
I'm serious, Billy, I will.
I'm serious too, he said, then forced himself to add, I want to hear it all. For a long moment, she looked at him like the liar he was, then carried on.
It took me maybe 2 months before I had the courage to say something to him, even just bullshit. And I decided this one day, I was going to say, your sweater's so fly. I thought about saying, so tight, so dope, So gangsta, ill, fat, snap, the bomb, da bomb. But I liked fly the best, and at lunch, I finally went up to him in the cafeteria, but instead of saying, "Your sweater's so fly," I was nervous and I said, "My sweater's so fly," and the kids at his table heard it and they all started laughing. And he said, "Your sweater's so fly," but looking at them, not at me. "I'm happy for you," still looking at them, like to get their approval. And in that moment when he looked at them instead of me with that stupid grin on his face, I saw him for what he was, a self-centered, immature boy with a little bit of a cruel streak. But I had been in love, so the realization hit me like a train. I don't know if I felt like I actually hated him, but God, did he put a hole in my chest that day. Carlos came into the room, climbed into bed, curled into Carmen's side, and quickly fell asleep. Although his son still hadn't said a word about the other day, he'd been sleeping since then almost as much as his mother. Later, after school, I saw him go into our building and I didn't want to go inside. I didn't want to walk up the stairs with him. Didn't want to be in my room and hear his creaky bed over my head. So I just sat on the stoop, remembering his face when he said that. "Your sweater's so fly." Not even giving me the consideration of eye contact. And I'm just sitting there like that, feeling more and more humiliated, more and more like an invisible nothing. And then at one point I looked up and I saw these two guys coming towards our building, and the way they were carrying themselves made me nervous. Hoodies, sunglasses on a cloudy day, hands in pockets. They looked like surveillance photos of themselves. And then they stopped a few feet away, had a conversation. Then one of them came up to me, says, "Where's Eric Franco live at? What apartment?" And I knew, everybody in the building knew, Eric Franco dealt coke. But these guys didn't look like they were there to score. They looked like trouble. Carlos started to talk in his sleep, nonsense words addressed to his brother. Billy was deaf to it, but Carmen waited until her son was finished before going on. But instead of giving them his apartment, 5C, I don't remember consciously thinking about what could happen if I said 4F. But that's what came out of my mouth. Billy stood up. "Where are you going?" "What? Nowhere." "You're leaving?" Carmen saying it like leaving her. "No, I was just stretching," he said idiotically. "Can you sit down?" "I'm down," he said. "I'm right here." He began to reach for her hand, then withdrew, sensing that whatever she needed right now, physical contact, was not on the list. I don't know if I really heard the gunshot from the fourth floor or just imagined that I did. I don't see how I could have. It was a .22 handgun going off inside a six-story building. But all of a sudden, I felt this gripping sensation inside my chest. And a minute or two later, those two came back out of the building the same way they went in, not rushed, looking around without seeming to be. And after they walked past me, they stopped and had another one of those side-mouth conversations, and I knew they were discussing what to do about me, the witness. I was staring at the ground. I could no more run at that moment than I could fly. I was totally theirs, whatever they wanted to do with me, but when I finally managed to raise my head, they were gone. Carm. What happened was that they rang the bell, and when Rudy opened the door, they shot him through the eye, and the bullet went into his brain. Carmen. But I killed him. Nobody could tell me different. I knew what I knew before I knew it. 4F, I said. Carmen, listen to me. The killers were the killers. Billy, don't. They're the ones who had the guns. Billy, I'm begging you. Carmen, you were a kid, 15. You said so yourself. The cops came to our door later that day, doing a canvas of the building. Nobody could figure out why this basically no trouble to any one boy was executed. And when they came to our apartment, I hid in the bathroom while they talked to my mother. And when they left, I told her that I saw the killers. I talked to them. And first she turned white. Then, without even giving me 2 minutes to pack or say goodbye to my brother, She dragged me out of the apartment and into a cab for Port Authority and put me on a bus to live with my father in Atlanta. And when I was down there, I heard that Milton and Edgar killed the guys that killed their brother. Then later I heard that Edgar was killed in return, and that their mother died soon after, and now Milton's gone.
He's gone? He was here to kill you.
And now you understand why.
Carmen, how many lives have you saved in that hospital? How many people are still walking the earth because of you?
So whatever the law thinks of me, and it doesn't think anything of me at all about this, I know what I did.
Billy's impulse was to once again try to defend her from herself. But he finally accepted the fact that all he'd be doing was causing her more pain. So, she said after a long moment, you tell me about Pavlicek, about Yasmin, about Jimmy Whelan, what they did and why. But I've got more souls to answer for than any of them, and I live with that every day. I see the Ramos family every day. I say I'm sorry to them so many times in my head from morning to night it's like I have a chemical disorder.
Billy finally, cautiously, lay down next to her.
I know you want to give me absolution, Billy, but you don't have that power. I wish you did.
Then,
but at least now you know.
Too early the next morning, Billy found himself sitting alone at the kitchen table, staring out the window at the askew backboard in the driveway, his coffee as cold as a pond. Immediately after unloading to him about her part in the destruction of the Ramos family, Carmen had proceeded to pass out, was still passed out, Billy checking the wall clock 15 hours later. He couldn't count the times he'd seen that in murderers who'd finally owned up to what they had done, straight back to the cell in their first peaceful sleep in weeks, months, years. You couldn't wake them with grenades. His phone rang, Redmond, Billy killing it directly. The day before, Yasmin and Whelan had tried to call him too. If he had picked up for either of them, his guess then was, the conversation would center strictly on asking how his family was doing. For them to ask where he was at in regards to turning them in so soon after what he'd been through would have been a grievous error in judgment on their part, and they'd know that. Nonetheless, the 7-day grace period he had given them to get ahead of their situations was more than half over. But as far as he knew, not one of them had even walked into a lawyer's office yet, let alone stepped into a precinct with a story to tell. His take was that they were all banking on the trauma, hoping that in the aftermath of what had happened to him and his family, he would be thrown into such a state of emotional chaos that he would no longer have the time, the brain cells, or the heart to follow through on his own ultimatum. Hearing the thump of his father's New York Times landing on the porch, Billy opened the door and saw a Chevy Tahoe sitting silently at the foot of his driveway, Yasmin staring out at him through the windshield. At least she knew enough not to come to the door. Billy walked down the driveway, taking his coffee with him, and settled into the passenger seat without a word. She had barely brushed her hair and was wearing nothing more than a heavy sweater thrown over pajamas, the first time he'd seen her without the Tibetan coat in months.
Hey, I called you so many times you didn't answer. I just had to come by.
Billy looked at his watch. 5:45 a.m.
I know, I'm sorry. I couldn't sleep, she said. I just want to know how everybody's holding up.
We'll get through.
I can't imagine. That must have been such a nightmare for you.
I don't want to talk about it.
No, I understand, she said quickly. I understand. I should go home.
Running her palms along the top of her steering wheel but making no move to start up the car. She had no more driven up here to ask after his family than she had come for the latest MBA scores, the musk of her anguish growing so intense that he had to crack his window.
Sorry, she said. I just ran out of the house.
This picture, Billy tapping the laminated photo of her daughters that hung from the neck of her rearview mirror. Was that always there, or did you just put it up this morning?
No, she said faintly. That's just my girls, you know.
The first aureole of the season caught his eye, a dash of bright against the early spring drab.
Just my girls, she murmured.
looking off. He removed the photo from its bead chain, flipped it into her lap.
You see them? What the hell were you thinking?
It was do what I did or go kill myself. Better a mother in Bedford Hills than in a grave.
I can't hear this shit,
he said, reaching for the door handle. Yasmin grabbed his hand.
You don't think I know what I did?
She warbled.
You think I didn't know how I'd be after that? But at least I'm alive. It was me or him.
Which him?
What?
Cortez or Banyan?
I didn't go near Cortez, she said.
So clean hands on that one, right? Up on the porch, Milton Ramos was leaning against the front door at an impossibly low angle, his rigid body inches from the ground, Billy taking him in and then lifting his eyes to the bedroom window, to Carmen up there desperately trying to exercise her history via hibernation. And all he wanted to do right now was join her. All he wanted to do right now was to be free of himself, free of all the bodies, and tend to his family.
What happened to your coat? He said, his gaze still fixed on the window.
What? I burned it.
Just as well.
What do you mean?
She said quietly.
I mean, next time you buy a jacket, take a girlfriend.
Billy, say what you mean. Yasmin, tilting toward him now, as taut as a bird. Billy took a sip of the cold coffee, then opened his door, tossed the rest onto the driveway. You know, he said, sometimes when I draw a slow night and I can duck out early, I'd be coming around that curve right about now, sliding for home.
Billy, please.
Sitting out here like this, he said, it's like I'm waiting for myself to show up.
Fucking Billy,
Yasmin blurted as she keyed the ignition.
Fucking Billy.
The unexpected blast of Mariah Carey coming through the car's speakers made her scream. Enough. You get a lawyer yet? He said, turning off the radio.
There's a guy, she said sullenly. I'm going to see him today.
Save your money, he said, finally stepping out of the car.
What?
But she knew what. Yasmin clamping a hand across her mouth like a muzzle, the tears running over her knuckles. And do your crying at home. Carmen stumbled into the kitchen an hour later, her face a blur.
How long was I out for?
Long enough.
Then why am I still so exhausted? She said,
wandering over to pour herself some coffee. I heard Victor's going home tomorrow, he said.
He is.
Does he know?
About Milton?
About you, he said.
Me? No, I couldn't ever tell him.
Well, maybe you can now.
Now I need to.
Just wait a little while until he settles in with the babies.
Of course, she said, of course.
Yasmin drove up this morning.
This morning?
Lowering herself into the chair next to his.
I didn't hear anything.
She stayed in her car.
Did you talk to her?
Yeah, I did.
And?
And it's over, he said.
Over? What do you mean, over?
Then,
with just her or all of them?
Billy shrugged. They sat in silence for a while, Carmen joining him and looking out at the backyard.
I'm glad, she finally said. Thank you.
He wanted to say that he didn't do it for her, but who knew? Milton Ramos reappeared, this time sitting on the living room couch, immobile yet full of murderous despair. Well, Billy told himself, what did you expect? And if Carmen hadn't seen him yet, she'd see him soon enough. I think I got up too early, he said.
Me too,
she said, reaching for but missing his hand.
Let's go back to bed.
The call from Stacy Taylor came a week later.
I need to tell you something.
What's that?
Have breakfast with me. It's a long story.
Give me the headline.
Just have breakfast with me, she said. You'll be glad you did.
You said that the last time.
This time I mean it.
I have a therapy session at 2.
Physical?
Family.
Where?
West 40s.
Then come after.
Your whale, Curtis Taft? she said to him over a 4 p.m. breakfast in another one of her tin can diners.
He shot his girlfriend last night.
Girlfriend or wife? Billy asked, thinking of Patricia Taft, big and stately, pushing a stroller that day through the atrium of the hospital.
Girlfriend.
You have a funny definition of good news.
She'll live, Stacy said, fondling an unopened pack of Parliaments. But he also clipped the first EMT coming through the door, so he's most likely going away just this side of forever.
So yeah, good news, he guessed. But it left him flat. He got away with a triple, he said. Skated like Brinker.
You catch them for what you catch them for, she said.
You told me that.
Memory Williams, Tanya Howard, Drina Bailey, he said loudly enough to turn heads.
And Eric Cortez, Sweet Pea Harris, Jeffrey Banyan, if he was taking a true tally.
The food came. Two omelets that were so oily they looked shellacked.
So in other news, sliding her plate to the side, I've been hearing some wild rumors about bad guys getting taken out by frustrated cops.
Frustrated, huh? Billy thinking. Maybe the center would hold for them and maybe not, but if she had really called him here hoping he would help her out, she was dreaming.
He would no more talk to her about any of his friends than they would have talked about him 18 years earlier. Ignoring the food, he took a sip of coffee.
Where'd you hear that?
You know I can't say. Journalistic ethics? He said with more of an edge than he'd intended. The dig deflated her like a pin.
Yeah, well, we used to hear bullshit rumors like this all the time back at the Post. They rarely came to anything.
He wanted to remind her that rarely wasn't the same as never. That 18 years ago, when she was young and mad ambitious, words like rarely, unlikely, implausible, would never have slowed her down. But what would have been the point? The woman sitting across from him, gray in face and grown so bony in middle age that he could count the knobs of her spine through her pullover, just didn't have the heart for the chase anymore. Rarely, these days, justification enough for her to fold her tent and go home to her wine and her cigarettes and her death wish drunk of a boyfriend.
I need to tell you something, he said, before he could stop himself.
Tell me something?
Stacy looking at him warily, not liking his suddenly breathy tone.
It's about me and you, Billy thinking. She can get back in the game with this. Get back in the game and redeem her good name.
Can I go outside for a smoke first? She nearly pleaded, her eyes pierced with dread.
Her resistance to finally hearing the words that would vindicate the last two punishing decades of her life at first baffled him, then sobered him. What the hell was he thinking? The consequences for his family and for himself?
Forget it. It's nothing.
He knew she wouldn't press, and she didn't. Stacy masking her relief by pretending that something out on the street had caught her eye. And Billy, playing his part, started attacking his eggs as if they were edible.
Let me ask you something, she said after a while. Whether you were or weren't high that day and that psycho with the pipe was still bearing down on you like that, would you have done anything differently?
Hypothetically, he said.
No, I don't think so.
Then,
no, I wouldn't.
Stacy went back to gazing out the window, her thin features vanishing in the late afternoon sunlight that slanted through the glass.
I mean, it's not like I never think about getting back into some kind of reporting, she said, tentatively pressing her fingertips against her throat. But that sex advice column for men that I write, we had 9,000 hits last issue, up from 5,500 the issue before, up from 3,000 the issue before that. So I think it's safe to say that I'm onto something.
Billy nodded in gratitude.
Can I go out and have my cigarette now? She said.
Pavlicek tried to ring through as he was leaving the diner, the only one of them who hadn't attempted to contact him in the days after Ramos. The others had stopped calling directly after his talk with Yasmin, Billy assuming that no one wanted to risk a conversation that, if they said the wrong thing or adopted the wrong tone, might prompt him to change his mind. Yet Pavlicek hadn't called even once, and so on the third attempted ring through, coming 40 minutes after the first, Billy yielded to his curiosity and picked up. But instead of getting Pavlicek on the other end, the voice Billy heard was Redmond's.
"It's John Jr.," he said. "The funeral's here on Thursday."
Unlike the homecoming for Martha Timberwolf, Jr.'s service was standing room only. At first, when he entered the already crowded chapel with his wife and kids, Billy wondered if he had it in him to let himself go, even just for this day. But when he saw Pavlicek lumbering wild-eyed between the casket and Redmond's piano like a chained bear, he couldn't help but wade through the crowd and grab him.
"It's over now, right?"
Pavlicek said too brightly, his breath rank with grief.
"All over but the shouting."
"Sure," Billy said, wishing it were so.
"Come here."
Pavlicek taking Billy by the elbow and steering him to the side of the open coffin.
"Look at this. Can you believe this?"
Touching his son's rigid left pinky sticking out from the folded repose of his crossed hands.
"He looks like some fucking fop holding a teacup, and this here?"
Running a finger down the left side of Junior's jaw, the skin there three shades darker than on the right.
"And his hair. I don't know what Redmond was thinking, but this kid never had a pompadour in his life."
Pavlicek's tone was crisp and snappy and jarringly unaffected by the tears that slipped down his face in sheets.
"I mean, I never thought our friend was the greatest mortician on the planet, but this is ridiculous."
"Maybe he just doesn't get to work much on white people," Billy said carefully.
"And see, I put this in,"
pointing to his own gold shield tucked into a corner of the casket.
"And this,"
lifting out a framed photo of the two of them taken in Amsterdam a few years earlier.
"And this,
a snapshot of Junior as a toddler with his mother before she tried to drown him. I really debated putting that one in, but..." The disconnect between voice and tears continued, Billy wondering how long he could keep it up.
"You ever read that?"
Pavlicek asked, pointing to a paperback copy of Steppenwolf near Junior's feet.
"Last year he told me that it changed his life, so I tried to get through it a few times to see what he saw."
The tears finally beginning to climb into his throat.
"But honestly, I thought it was crap. Anyways, it's all over now, right? All over but the shouting."
"Johnny," Billy said, stepping back from Junior's body. "I'm dying for you." Embarrassed by his choice of words, Billy began to apologize. But he needn't have bothered, given that Pavlicek had already turned away and was now engaged in giving Ray Rivera, father of the murdered Thomas, the same manic tour of the coffin and its contents as he had given Billy. They were all there with their families, those who had families. Yasmin, Dennis, and the girls. Redmond, who had prepared the body but turned the service over to his father so he could participate purely as a mourner, standing with Nola, Rafer, and two of his six or seven other sons. And Jimmy Whelan, who at least had the sense for once not to bring a date. They all had made some sort of contact with Billy, mostly sober nods, a few terse greetings. Yasmin going so far as to hug Carmen and make a quiet fuss over the kids. But for the most part, they kept their distance, which he thought was more about letting sleeping dogs lie than anything else. And he was fine with it. He preferred it.
"I believe it's time,"
Redmond's father announced with soft authority,
"for us all to be seated."
Junior apparently had been utterly indifferent to the notion of any kind of God, and so Pavlicek, no Bible beater himself, passed on having any kind of religious celebrant and instead turned the program over to his son's friends, who served up half a dozen well-spoken homages, an acoustical duet on I'll Fly Away, and a teary solo of Angels Among Us, sung by a young woman who had been the closest thing Junior had had to a girlfriend in the last year of his life. When the woman returned to her seat, a retired detective from Bronx Homicide, not on the program, spontaneously got up and sang an a cappella version of Eric Clapton's Tears in Heaven, which had half the room weeping like babies, including Carlos and Declan, hardly more than babies themselves. Billy didn't know what unnerved him more, his two sons' intuitive empathy in a room beyond their experience, or the sight of Jimmy Whelan, the childless, mateless, eternally diffident ghetto harem keeper, sobbing more loudly than anyone else. As for Billy himself, the last couple of weeks had utterly tapped him out, and it would take a lot more than a sad pop tune with a painful backstory to get him weeping. Redmond Sr., seemingly singing directly to Junior's father, closed out the concert with, "The Battle Is Not Yours." And then it was his time. Pavlicek rising from the front row, giving his back to the room as he silently leaned over the coffin. Billy could hear him whispering something to his son, but too indistinctly for anyone to make out. Then finally turning to the assembled, the expression on his face near homicidal.
"I don't know if anyone came here to celebrate John Jr.'s life, but I certainly didn't," he said, gripping the podium as if he wanted to crush it. "I am here before you. I am here among you to rage and curse God for the arbitrarily murdering fuck that he is. Not that I'm the first parent ever to feel that way. And to grant myself at least one afternoon where suicide would be logistically difficult." Tickled by the profanity, Carlos looked up at Billy and grinned. "You know, you read the papers after a young man dies in this city, someone's always saying he was just starting to get his life together. He was just talking about going back to school, getting his GED, getting a job, talking about being a real father to his daughter, talking about getting away from the hood, about enlisting, about marrying his fiancée. He was just about to do this, to do that. All these justs, whether they were true or not, because they all died young and just was all they had. Tomorrow was all they had. And the same could be said for my boy. He was just about to finish his schooling. He was just about to find his own way in the world. Just about to show me the man that now he'll never get to be. The man that over the years would have null and voided every hardship, every heartache I've ever endured in my life." Pavlicek paused, returned to the coffin as if for a quick consultation, then turned back to the seats. "You want to hear what a great kid he was? How his heart was pure gold? How he loved life, loved people, loved the challenge, all that boilerplate, etc., etc.? For those of you who want to hear all that, consider it said. The fact of the matter was that he was just about to be, and now he's not." Looking around the room, Billy noted that all three of the WGs were in tears, their faces in various states of contortion. Even Redmond, king of the poker face and impresario of 75 to 100 memorials like this every year, was swiping at his cheeks with those mile-long fingers of his. They had all killed or been complicit in a killing, out of passion but clear-eyed and purposefully. But they had no problem giving in to their grief when it came to one another. He had nearly lost his mind trying to bring them to justice, turning on his longtime friends in order to do what was right, what he thought was right. And as a result, his own eyes on this day were as dry as sand. Still, they had all been so tight over the last 2 decades, had gone through so much together, and for one mad minute, Billy's anger at them for excluding him from their murderous plans trumped his outrage at what they had done. But instead of passing, the anger lingered. Billy wondering if this pop-up fury he was experiencing over having been shut out from this most desperate of compacts between friends hadn't been a part of his anger at them since the beginning. "There's some people in this room right now," Pavlicek said, "who gave 20 years or more to the job, myself included. We've seen it all, handled it all. And when a young person dies, we've all walked up the stairs, knocked on the doors, and delivered the news, between us, to an army of parents. We've caught them on their way to the floor, carried them into the bedroom or living room, then gone into their kitchens and brought them water. Over the years, an ocean of water, glass by glass by glass. And so after all that, we think we understand what it must feel like to be one of those parents. But we don't. We can't. I still can't. But I'm getting there.
Billy reflexively looked across the room at Ray Rivera, expecting him to be nodding in agreement, but instead saw a profile carved in stone. "But so my son." Pavlicek paused, looking about himself as if he had misplaced something, then seemed to give up on finding it.
"I think I just want to read this," he said, pulling an envelope out of his jacket pocket and removing a single page cut from a book. "This was handed to me today by a friend, and it's as good a farewell to him as anything else."
And then after giving it one last silent read, Pavlicek began to recite, tone deaf to the rhythm of the words.
"These hearts were woven of human joys and cares, washed marvelously with sorrow, swift to mirth. The years had given them kindness. Dawn was theirs, and sunset, and the colors of the earth."
It was Rupert Brooke's sonnet, "The Dead." The Dead 4, actually, Billy knowing this because his father had read it to him more than once when he was a kid, and when Billy became older more than once, he had read it himself. "He leaves a white, unbroken glory, a gathered radiance, a width, a shining peace under the night." At the end of the service, Pavlicek chose to stand at the head of the open coffin to once again receive mourners, the line extending from the front of the chapel to the small windowless vestibule and out into the street.
"It's over now, right?" Pavlicek chanted to Billy. "All over but the shouting."
"It's over," Billy said. "Everything." Despite his state, Pavlicek picked up on his meaning right away.
"Billy, I know what I did to you, what we all did to you, and I'm sorry."
"Not for today," Billy said. "Today is today, all right?"
"We just knew if you ever..."
Pavlicek began, then cut himself off, leaving Billy to wonder how he had intended to finish that sentence. "Another day, okay?"
"All right," Pavlicek said. "Another day."
As Billy turned to step away, Pavlicek grabbed his wrist.
"You hear about Curtis Taft?"
"I did," Billy said.
"I don't know. Maybe that day we gave him PTSD. Maybe we drove him to that."
"Not today, okay?"
"I mean, I sure fucking hope so."
Pavlicek rasped with a kind of black glee. Billy looking into his eyes and absolutely knowing that if time ever folded in on itself and Pavlicek had it to do all over again, to put another bullet into the back of Eric Cortez's skull, or to re-murder any of the other whites by gun, blade, or with his bare hands, he'd go about it with joy. Turning back to the mourners, Billy saw that Whelan, Redmond, and Yasmin, each standing in a different part of the room, had all been quietly observing the conversation, their expressions before they one by one turned away from him, flat-eyed and alert. Billy thinking, and so would they all. The car was parked 4 blocks uptown from the funeral home, and as they headed north on Adam Clayton Boulevard, the boys serpentined like loons before them, racing up every stoop and making a show of high-jumping over every minuscule bit of crap on the sidewalk. "That poem he read?" Billy said to Carmen. "It's from World War I. It made me think of my dad."
"Well, it should. He gave it to me this morning to give to John."
"My father did? I was right there when he gave it to me.
I didn't even know he knew about the funeral."
"Then, why didn't he give it to me?"
"I think he knew, he knows, what's going on with you and the others, so he gave it to me instead."
"And how the hell does he know that?"
"Don't ask me," Carmen said. "He's your father."
Later, as they unloaded the kids in the driveway and then entered the house, Billy remembered that he was supposed to go in tonight, his first tour back after 2 weeks on medical leave. "I'm thinking about calling in sick," he said to Carmen in the kitchen. "I don't really want to go."
"I think you should," she said.
"I don't think I'm up for it."
"I think you should,"
she repeated on her way to the freezer for the vodka, then to the cabinet for 2 juice glasses. "Yeah, how about you?" Billy watching her pour out too much, a sure sign of a non-drinker, which under normal circumstances, she was. I already called the hospital, told them to put me back on the schedule starting tomorrow. You sure you're up for it?
Keep calm and carry on, she said, raising her glass.
What?
I saw it on a refrigerator magnet.
Carmen taking a sip and making a face.
I mean, Jesus, Billy, what else can we do?
His third run that night was on Madison Avenue, a 4 a.m. smash and grab of a tiny jewelry store set inside the exterior arcade of an office building in Midtown. Almost all of the stock snatched out of the brick-bashed window, nothing much to see now but bare earring trees and daggers of broken glass. At this hour, the Canyon Street was a ghost town, and Billy easily spotted the late-model Nissan Pathfinder slowly approaching from three blocks south. When it finally pulled to the curb, an elderly woman sporting a high helmet of frosted tangerine hair, lipsticked and dressed in a nubby plaid skirt suit as if she had been sitting up all night waiting for the phone to ring, stepped carefully out of the passenger side door onto Madison. The driver, her husband, Billy assumed, remained behind the wheel with the engine still running, staring straight ahead as if waiting for the light to change. She absorbed the carnage without expression.
I've been here 37 years and nothing ever happened, she said quietly, a soft thread of old Europe running through her words.
When Billy was a kid, all of his aunts had filigreed birdcage hair like hers, and he could never figure out how they slept. How's your insurance? The woman blushed.
It only covers jewelry that's in the safe.
How much is in the safe?
I have arthritis. Every little piece, in and out, morning and night, takes me 2 hours. I can't do it anymore.
She was wiped out. Is that your husband? Billy asked. She glanced at the old guy still behind the wheel, but said nothing.
And where was he tonight?
Theodore Moretti asked.
Do I even have to answer a question like that?
The woman addressed Billy more amazed than insulted. He had no idea how Moretti had gotten back on the sign-up sheet after being blackballed just a month before, but he had. I thought you were at the 3-2, Billy snapped. Moretti's cell rang and he walked down the block, hissing into his shoulder.
What happens now?
She asked. Billy picking up on that near-buried refugee inflection again, thinking, this is nothing for her. Before he could respond, a patrol car flying the wrong way down Madison came to a rocking stop in front of the store. One of the uniforms jumped out, holding a black plastic garbage bag. We caught the guy running on Park, he said, gesturing to the head-down, handcuffed thief in the back seat. I feel like goddamn Santa Claus. The woman took the bag and peered inside at her life, then up at Billy.
Who would do such a thing?
I hate to say it, Billy said, but all of this has to be vouched as evidence. She looked at him blankly, Billy unable to tell whether she didn't understand him or didn't care. Nonetheless, he decided it was a reasonably happy ending. This is Ari Fliakos. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Whites by Richard Price, writing as Harry Brandt. This program was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Laura Wilson, recorded by Maddie Argyropoulos, post-production by Danny Meltzer, text copyright 2015 by Richard Price, production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio, all rights reserved.